by providing superior service. When it does, the end user of its medical, financial, or legal services comes out healthier, wealthier, safer. Service pros devote their talents and skills to making life better for the consumer. Marketing tradition, therefore, portrays the professional as the facilitator, not the hero, and instead casts the consumer as the core character. The same applies to nonprofits such as non-governmental organizations, charities, and all branches of government. These three casting strategies served as guidelines for marketing stories throughout the last century. But then came the rise of the Internet. When shoppers went online to rate retailers, sometimes thanking them, often denouncing them, everything changed. Word of mouth became instantaneous and viral, making consumer centricity the mantra of modern marketing. Today, campaign after campaign characterizes corporate clients as service enterprises, whether they are or not, and casts their customers as protagonists. All good. Consumer-centric storytelling marks a positive evolution in world commerce, so long as the tellings are creatively compelling, pander-free, and most important, honest. Millennial and Generation Z consumers detest BS. The empathy imperative. If your target audience member does not sense a mutual humanity between herself and your story's core character, she will not care, not listen, not identify, not be moved to act. Empathy is absolute. This principle should be self-evident. Yet, rather than rewrite an uninspired story, marketers often call upon this classic rationalization. No matter how trite the story may be, if its core character looks and sounds like the typical buyer, then emotional involvement clicks in automatically. Therefore, the cure to banality is casting. This logic, as painful experience teaches, is fallacious. And every woman protagonist is no guarantee of customer centricity. What the customer wants is a human affinity, not a cliched facsimile. In fact, for many business stories, the only logical choice for protagonist is a product or a corporation. If so, the tale must be told from that point of view. To do so, however, the storyteller faces this challenging problem. How can I fuse an empathetic connection between consumer and protagonist when the latter is either an inanimate object or an impersonal institution? Product identification. A protagonist, by definition, must be able to choose with a free will. A product, however, is a thing, and things have no self-awareness, no willpower, and therefore cannot make choices or take actions. The common solution calls on fantasy. Either an actor or an animated character personifies the product, or an Oz-like world brings things to life. Recent campaigns for Pier One, Nest Labs, and Geico Insurance feature talkative teapots, chatty suburban homes, and an irrepressible Australian reptile. Fantasy worlds and characters demand imagination, innovation, and creative execution. Rather than face that task, many campaigns abandon storytelling in favor of a spokesperson bragging and making promises the product's performance may or may not be able to keep. Corporate identification. As set out in the previous chapter, a demonstrably human quality deep within a core character embodies the story's center of good, its magnet for empathy. To turn a corporation into an empathetic protagonist, the marketer first must identify the company's primal value, a value so essential to its nature that if it were lost, the company would disappear with it. Next, the marketer must infuse the corporation as core character with this value and put it into play as the protagonist's choices and actions build the story. In practice, however, when corporations take on a core character role, the center often seems void. Some companies get the naming rights to a stadium in the hope of buying lovability. PR firms perform heart transplants by betting their clients with charities. Philanthropy provides material for press releases, but its benefits seldom overcome the buying public's antipathy to multinationals. Always bear in mind that the center of good expresses itself in action, not association. A corporate mission, however, tells another story. Starbucks, P&G, Royal DSM, and many other firms have taken up social causes such as educating the unfortunate, rebuilding after disasters, and curing third world diseases. Not only do the stories these missions generate cast their corporations in a humanitarian role, thus drawing empathy, but, unlike self-congratulatory PR pieces, they also span a negative to positive arc that makes the purpose-told story unnatural. Brand identification. Each person draws her personal identity from the culture that surrounds her. When asked who they are, people name their nationality, tribe, religion, profession, and marital status, along with the music, films, books, art, cuisine, and sports teams they love. They might add some experiences and achievements unique to themselves, but these too have been influenced by the culture that clothed them since birth. This was always the way of things until modern life added one more dimension: brands. In the first half of the 20th century, people hid labels or cut them off. No longer. Identification with brands and the phenomenon of badging that came with it arrived post-World War II and took up residence on Madison Avenue. Today, people flaunt logos across their chests. These badges not only advertise the brand itself, but suggest their owner's taste, class, politics, sexuality, personality, and much, much more. Brands, whether resource, product, or service-centric, are often more massive and complex than many third-world countries. They represent both a corporation in the background and a lifestyle in the foreground. Each brand radiates a presence in the world, surrounded by its own unique aura. IBM equals genius. Budweiser equals good times. Louis Vuitton equals luxury. This essential quality has been earned through decades of hard work. So when a marketing story stars a corporation or its product, the brand's aura should become the protagonist's persona, and the storytelling should reinforce this personality. Avoid overdogs. When casting your protagonist, bear in mind the self-contradictory dynamics of your fellow human beings. A person can find her identity in anything from torn jeans to a diamond ring, from Big Macs to haute cuisine. So while people use products to shape their sense of self, that doesn't mean they empathize with the corporations that make them. People do not identify with power. They respect it, shelter in it, rebel against it, worship it, but they rarely empathize with it. The wealthiest of people, for example, often need high-end luxury goods to confirm their identity. Despite their obvious social prestige, they lie awake at night, feeling in their heart of hearts like an underdog. This perception is virtually universal. When human beings survey their place in the world, they instinctively feel that they're up against overwhelming forces that stretch from the unpredictability of love to the inevitability of death. Weighed against the sum total of negative forces in life, We all feel, to some degree, on certain days, like an underdog. When your story's inciting incident upsets the balance of your protagonist's life, the audience should sense that she's up against powerful antagonistic forces. The perception of underdogness draws empathy faster than any other cause. So above all else, avoid overdog protagonists. If you cast a corporation as protagonist, do not brag about its size, its reach, its wealth, its influence. If you cast a product as protagonist, do not brag about its newness, its hipness, its celebrity. The world spares no empathy for an overdog. Market with a graceful humility. Step 3. Creation of setting. Social and physical location. The social and physical settings for purpose-told stories range from the conceptual to the concrete, from animated to real-world grit, from a sole individual to a massive society. Compare the storytelling in two Apple commercials, Get a Mac and Misunderstood. The enormously successful Get a Mac campaign ran from 2006 through 2009 and told 66 different 30-second stories. Each featured two characters symbolizing competing computer brands standing against an abstract, ultra-minimalist, milk-white background. One dressed in casual clothes, actor Justin Long, and introduced himself as a Mac computer. The other dressed in a suit and tie, comedian John Hodgman, and declared that he was a PC. In each mini-story, a conflict quickly develops between the two computers, then pivots around a single turning point, with the Mac always winning. The Get a Mac campaign received the Grand Effie Award in 2007. In Misunderstood, realism rules as a true-to-life family celebrates Christmas in a true-to-life suburban home. The ad's ultra-naturalistic images tell the story of a teenage loner surrounded by a lively family gathering, but spending his day face-deep in an iPhone. With a bolt of surprise, the turning point reveals that, in fact, the kid has used his iPhone to make a mini-film celebrating his family's joy-filled holiday. This ad played through the 2013 Christmas season and won a Creative Arts Emmy for Outstanding Commercial. Wherever you physically and socially set the story defines and limits what's possible in the story. Only certain things are possible in a given world. Location and duration in time. Now and then, advertisers set stories in the past, the future, or even the timeless worlds of the Brothers Grimm and Hans Christian Andersen to showcase everything from hair products, Rapunzel, to bedroom furniture, The Princess and the Pea. But in most purpose-told stories, familiarity and accessibility guide the choice of temporal setting, placing the vast majority of these stories in a realistic, contemporary world. Length of time is a different matter. Storytelling has the magical piston-like power to compress time, turning an hour into an instant. A TV commercial, for example, might dramatize an entire wedding in 30 seconds, while an investment prospectus squeezes decades of corporate history into half a dozen pages. This works to a marketer's great advantage. You have the flexibility to use as much of the protagonist's life as you need to craft your story. Stage 3. The inciting incident. An inciting incident launches a story by suddenly throwing its protagonist's life out of kilter, changing the core values charge sharply to the positive or negative. This surprising event grabs the customer's curiosity and pulls him through the telling by raising a question only the climax can answer. How will this turn out? In the purpose-told story, the precise quality of the inciting incident and the imbalance it causes depends on the nature of the protagonist. If, for example, your core character represents a corporation, possible inciting incidents range from mergers and acquisitions to takeovers and lawsuits. If your story stars a product, starting events run from innovation to obsolescence. If the consumer fills this role, anything can happen to a human being, from giving birth to losing a loved one. But no matter how you characterize your protagonist, his reaction to the inciting incident should draw the audience's empathy and emotional concern, placing him at the story's center of good. By doubling the involvement via both curiosity and empathy, you transform the customer's passing interest into suspense, laying the groundwork for the surprise that springs loose in stage five. What's more, from the audience's viewpoint, the sudden reversal of fortune in the protagonist's life mirrors the customer's life and reflects his target need, the unsatisfied desire that the marketer discovered while researching the story's setups. This hook begins the mirror story that will carry the audience to climax and declare the call to action. Consider, for example, December 21st, the campaign created by Leo Burnett Madrid for the Spanish National Lottery. As background, the Spanish Christmas Lottery is the second oldest lottery in the world, operating continuously since 1812. Over two centuries, it has become a national phenomenon, with 75% of Spaniards participating in the annual drawing. In 2016, the lottery sold more than 2.6 billion euros in tickets for its once-a-year Christmas drawing. The Christmas lottery operates differently from many other lotteries. There are just 100,000 potential winning numbers, from 00000 to 99999. The top prize, called El Gordo, or the fat one for this and other lotteries, pays 4 million euros to each ticket holder who has selected the precise number drawn. In 2016, 165 winning El Gordo tickets won a combined 660 million euros. Individual lottery tickets cost 200 euros, much more than most individuals are prepared to pay. Each ticket, however, is divided into 10 perforated sub-tickets called decimos, enabling groups of people to purchase tickets together. Each decimo receives 10% of the winnings of each ticket. With this approach, the lottery unites friends and colleagues each year with a shared dream just before the holidays. In recent years, social fragmentation in Spain has expanded beyond typical political debate, due in part to the growing Catalan independence movement. These divisions presented a threat to the shared ticket model. Would groups form less often to buy tickets together? If so, would participating in the lottery be viewed as a selfish act? The lottery turned to storytelling not just to combat this risk, but also to position the lottery as something that helps unite people. December 21st opens in a coastal Spanish town as a doting grandmother prepares a light breakfast of fruit, toast, and milk for her grandson. She thoughtfully arranges his meal on a tray and carries it to him in the living room. The grandson, focused on his phone, absently dismisses her, saying he's not hungry. As he does, the television in the room draws her attention as an announcer calls the live drawing for El Gordo. The grandmother rushes to find her ticket and watches in amazement as ball after ball her number is drawn. Stunned, she rushes out of the house to find one of the neighbors with whom she shared the winning ticket. As soon as she departs, however, the television announcer returns, explaining, And that's how the drawing went last year. Tomorrow is the big day. Her son then enters, asking the distracted grandson, "Where's Grandma?" The grandson replies, "Outside to find her friend. She thinks she's won the lottery." Suddenly concerned, her son starts after her, his life having been thrown out of balance. The grandmother's misunderstanding triggers the inciting incident of the story. It hooks audience attention by causing viewers to wonder, what will happen next? That scene also establishes empathy for our protagonist. As the story progresses, the townspeople, the lottery's customers, emerge as a group protagonist. The worry on the face of one of the members of that group, her son, as he learns of her mistake, draws the audience into empathy. As audience members, we realize that if our own grandmother were confused, thinking she'd found life-changing good luck, we would want to protect her from harm and find some way to cushion her from the fall, just as the son seeks to do by following her into the street. Stage 4, the object of desire. Stage 4 focuses the audience's curiosity and empathy toward the story's climax. In order to restore life's equilibrium, the protagonist conceives of the specific goal or objective, a story component we referred to previously as the object of desire. Like the inciting incident, the object of desire in a purpose-told story varies with the identity of the protagonist, be it an enterprise, product, or customer. This focus of intent could be a physical thing, like a new iPhone, or a condition that improves life, such as financial security, a career promotion, or even something more abstract, like a dream of romance. To invent a one-of-a-kind telling, merge your knowledge with your imagination, and then ask, what exactly does my brand, corporation, product, or consumer want? With that answer in hand, ask two questions more. How does this object of desire relate to the core value of the story? For example, just, unjust, or rich, poor. And by extension, how does the story's core value relate to my company's core value? Your answers need not match perfectly, but they cannot be divorced. Values and desires must reflect each other and thus unify the story with the company that produces it. No matter how the object of desire is defined, as a thing or a situation, the central character feels he needs it to achieve a positive rebalance of his life. This desire drives him forward and powers your story. In December 21st, the town's object of desire is to help the grandmother avoid embarrassment and disappointment. To achieve that, a growing number of people will have to work together to execute an increasingly complex plan. As the story unfolds, the core value pair is revealed to be isolation, togetherness, taking us from the opening scene where the grandmother and grandson barely communicate to a very different conclusion. Stage 5, the first action. Stage 5 launches your protagonist's quest. To reach his object of desire, the core character takes an action based on his best sense of expectation. Spontaneously or consciously, he uses words and deeds as tactics to evoke the positive reactions he hopes to get from his world. The unique identity of the protagonist determines the unique actions he will take. Therefore, the creator of the purpose-told story must research the psychology of his core character in depth and detail. In the same way that the question, "What would my character want?" demands knowledge and imagination, so do the answers to, "What would my character expect to happen?" and therefore, "What would he do to make it happen?" Again, if we turn to the December 21st example, The son takes the first action on behalf of the group protagonist when he carries the grandmother's jacket outside, expecting he will tell her and wrap it around her for comfort. Until... Stage 6. The First Reaction. Stage 6 violates the protagonist's expectations. A gap of surprise cracks open between what he imagined would happen when he took action and his world's sudden, unforeseeable reaction. A reaction that's either different or more powerful or both at once. In the case of the Spanish lottery story, the son arrives to find his grandmother celebrating on the street with their neighbor, one of the other ticket holders who shares her number. The son and neighbor make eye contact, and the neighbor gives him a knowing look and shrugs as if to say, "Let her have her moment." A full-length work of fiction may pull this reaction from any combination of the various levels of conflict, inner, personal, social, or physical. Most marketing stories, however, are compact and sharply focused on results. They therefore rarely involve their characters at more than one level of conflict. Developing a compelling story means developing a conflict that relates to your audience, mirroring the positive-negative duality of their lives. Think about it. Life fills our hours with problems to be solved, needs to be met, desires to be satisfied, not enough time to get the job done, too far to go to get what you need, a romance on the rocks, an illness that resists cure. When negative forces block a character's desires, conflict compels her to reach deep within, make a tough choice, and then act. From the audience member's point of view, the protagonist's storied struggle mirrors their real-life struggle, thus focusing their attention, deepening involvement, and inspiring a purchase. The creative force that rouses powerful storytelling is, as Jean-Paul Sartre taught, scarcity. There simply isn't enough of anything in this world to go around. Not enough food, nor enough love, and never enough time. To satisfy human needs from their most basic to their most dream-filled, we must battle paucities that deny our yearnings. In short, the essence of reality is humanity's ongoing strivings against negation. Imagine a TV commercial with three cheerful, homespun scenes strung back to back. A very happy family, followed by an even happier family, topped by the happiest family the world has ever seen. What reaction would this triply sugared design evoke? The first spoonful might draw a smile, but the second will sour that grin, and the third will evoke a silent vow never to buy what's on offer. When mawkish ads drumbeat sentimentality, no one reaches for a credit card. Marketing stories move from problem to solution, not solution to solution to solution. A positive climax demands a negative setup. For no matter how happy a happy ending may be, if nothing but uplifting scenes precede it, redundancy erases those images from the audience's memory. The Law of Diminishing Returns. The more often a cause repeats, the less and less its effect. Repetition kills impact. This principle, put into action, falls into a pattern of thirds, to wit, the first time we experience something, it causes its full effect. The second experience causes half, or less than half, of its original effect. The third experience reverses itself and causes the opposite effect. The first piece of cheesecake tastes great. The second seems hard to swallow. The third makes you sick. The same pattern applies to story design. Story enemy number one is repetition and leads to story enemy number two, vacuity. Why do so many branding campaigns devolve into boring recitations of and then, and then, and then? Why do so many product and service ads deliver little, if any, impact? Answer, because their tellings deliberately avoid any hint of conflict. And why is that? Answer, negaphobia. Negaphobia, the fear of all things negative. Negaphobia is a byproduct of marketing education. Ever since the invention of the business school, and marketing as a unique discipline within its curriculum, marketers have been trained, as the old song goes, to accentuate the positive and eliminate the negative. What seemed like common sense and good manners has metastasized into an emotional contagion that now infects every dimension of corporate life, from outbound branding to inbound team building. Today, for example, the worst thing one employee might say about another is, "He's so negative." In all probability, the guy in question is simply a realist who sees things as they are, downsides and all. But from cubicle to cubicle, those who cannot face the sharp edges of reality tend to shun those who can. This negaphobic disdain for the truth is, of course, short-sighted, in that the career span of those who cannot face facts quickly abbreviates. So why would someone risk his or her future by ignoring what's real, no matter how negative? There are three primary causes. First, as mentioned, the business school dictum to protect your brand from any and all criticism. Second, the super-sensitive people of today's hyper-protective culture who find unpleasant truths intimidating. Third, people who want to cover their asses. Consider, for example, an ad with an intriguing negative inciting incident that sets up a splendid positive flourish at climax, but, for some unknown reason, does not increase sales. The real cause for the ad's failure may be found in any link along the chain from creation to distribution. But the finger of blame will immediately point to whoever dared okay the ad's negative floor. To preempt blame, marketing executives cover their butts by outlawing the least hint of anything negative in their ads. As an unfortunate result, negaphobia not only distorts their business judgment, but also sucks the impact out of their messaging. The principle of negation. A compelling marketing story encompasses the negative of life. And a story must establish its negative floor, either in stage two, when the inciting incident imbalances the protagonist's life, or here in stage six, as the story's forces of antagonism suddenly react against the protagonist. This surprise instantly pops the question why into the mind of character and audience alike. Curiosity drives them to look more deeply into the story's society and setting. As they suddenly discover the answer, they experience a rush of insight into the true forces that oppose the protagonist's desire and how his world actually works. Consumers love to realize the truth in this spontaneous, storified way. They want to be shown, not told. They don't want to sit in a classroom. They want a surprising, living discovery. This insight puts the consumer's mirror story on a path to solution and the satisfaction of her need. She doesn't know how it will be done, but it's out there, so she can't look away. This curiosity holds your prospect's attention, even in a world of constant distraction. Marketing stories are generally brief. The protagonist pursues her object of desire through usually only one turning point. However, in longer stories, such as our December 21st example, stages 5 and 6 build progressively. The antagonistic force that violated the protagonist's expectations in stage 6 now blocks the path to her object of desire. At the same time, however, this unforeseen reaction gives her a new understanding of her world. In stage 7, She puts this insight to work as she makes her final choice of action. Stage 7. Crisis Choice. Stage 7 brings the story to its crisis, the highest level of tension and suspense. The protagonist, based on her new knowledge, chooses a new tactic, one she hopes will create a reaction from her world that will deliver her object of desire. At this point, in most fiction-told stories, the protagonist stands in dilemma, forced to choose between either two irreconcilable positive possibilities or two equally repugnant negative choices. Never in a marketing story. Rather, the insight the protagonist gained in stage 6 now gives her a clear choice of what to do to get what she wants. She conceives her new tactic and takes it. As the protagonist acts, tension peaks, and the audience senses that the world's next reaction will answer the major dramatic question, how will this turn out? Events progress in December 21st, until the protagonists realize the day is coming to a close. As a wonderful lobster feast winds down, they know the grandmother will soon learn there is no 4 million euro prize coming her way. Her son makes the decision that they must tell her, and approaches to break the news. Stage 8. Climactic Reaction. Stage 8 delivers the goods. The protagonist's second action evokes a positive reaction from his world, giving him his object of desire and reestablishing the balance of his life. This climactic event not only satisfies your audience's emotional curiosity about the outcome of the story, but also dramatizes how they can solve the mirror problem in their own lives, how they, too, can get what they need and desire. Early in December 21st, after the son's first attempt to protect his mother fails, he and the neighbor Puri agree to celebrate her win at the pub. Immediately, forces of antagonism arise. The pub owner and other guests know that the lottery drawing has not yet happened. A single word from one passerby will shatter her extraordinary day. As the grandmother walks across town, her family and friends call ahead to alert the pub owner and ensure everyone there is ready to play along. Champagne is being poured as they arrive. After celebrating in the pub, the grandmother sets off to greet friends at her salon. The town involves more people to keep up the ruse, and a crowd begins to grow behind her. At one point, she wonders, shouldn't the television crews have arrived? Her son nearly throws in the towel and reveals the truth, but he's stopped by the previously disinterested grandson. Caught up in the spirit of the day, he sprints off to find friends with a video camera who can interview Grandma. While the townspeople thought that might satisfy her, at the end of the interview, she turns to the crowd and marshals them to the town lighthouse for a town-wide celebration. December 21st ends with a final twist. Before the son can break the truth to the grandmother, she stops him saying, "I know what you're going to say." He sighs, thinking she has already figured it out and been let down. Instead, she reaches into her pocket and hands him her winning lottery ticket, saying, "But you should always listen to your mother, and I will be much happier if you have this." He hugs her, makes eye contact with Puri, and they decide to let the ruse go on. In that moment, the audience is rewarded with a rush of insight. It was not the windfall of money that made the grandmother so excited. It was the happiness she knew it would bring to the town. In many ways, they might celebrate and live together. We realize, as the screen fades to black, that through their adventure that day, they had achieved that happiness through togetherness, whether El Gordo winners or not. December 21st executes its progressive complications brilliantly, holding the audience's attention to climax. The open mind moment. A story's climax impacts the audience's mind with a sudden rush of meaningful emotional insight, a flash of, I get it. In this instant, a flood of charged understanding opens the mind. Neuroscientists have measured this open mind phenomenon and found that it lasts for 6 to 8 seconds. In this moment of wonder and pleasure, anything presented to the mind lodges in its memory. Therefore, this is the spot where the wise marketer plants his logo. That's exactly what the Spanish Lottery does at the end of their 5-minute story, and beneath it, they feature their tagline, "There's no bigger prize than sharing." The call to action. The final effect of the open mind moment turns the entire story into a massive call to action that sends the audience member out into the real world to duplicate the protagonist's triumph. Wanting to relive the mirror story, she purchases the product or hires the service that's at the heart of the story. Explicit versus implicit storytelling. Now that we have reviewed the 8 stages of story, it's important to note that not every marketing story needs to take its audience through all 8 stages explicitly. The mind, as we've noted, is a story-taking and making machine. One key phrase or image may imply an entire story, as the audience's mind instantly imagines the unexpressed stages. Consider, for example, Nike's famous imperative, "Just do it." What story do those 3 words imply? It goes like this. I'm climbing the stairs one day and barely make it to the top. Protagonist in his setting. I suddenly realize that I've got to get in shape. Inciting incident. Before the stairs kill me. Object of desire, fitness. I buy a pair of Nikes and start to run. First action. The pain hits hard. First reaction. But I stick with it. Second action. Each day I push against the pain until I lose weight, feel great, enter the local 10K. Second reaction, climax. Call to action, buy Nike. A story doesn't even need words. Take, for example, the famous Michelin advertisement, featuring an image found on the PDF. What story runs through the mind at the sight of that ad? It might go like this. I'm driving, consumer as protagonist, along a curvy road on a stormy night, my family in the back seat, setting in balance. Suddenly, a truck jackknifes in front of me, inciting incident, putting them at risk. Object of desire, a safe, secure family. I swerve to the side, first action. My tires splash into the mud, first reaction. But as I swing around the spinning truck, second action, my Michelins grip the shoulder and I veer safely past the truck and back onto the asphalt, second reaction, climax. Thanks to my Michelins, I save my family's life. Call to action, buy Michelins. When told beautifully, a little goes a long way.
Part 3. Putting Story to Work. Introduction. Compelling subject matter promises a story worth telling, and mastery of story craft fulfills that promise. But to transform how your organization connects with its customers, the telling must be skillfully aimed and purposely told. And for that process to work, it needs a champion. This section begins with a look at the role the CMO plays in this new story-driven world. Once your organization has mastered story form, you must then learn to craft different types of stories to achieve different objectives. Part 3 explores the application of story to achieve 4 key goals. Branding, advertising to extend the lifespan of the current model, demand and or lead generation in a post-advertising world, and sales. Once we have examined story application, we will examine how to measure the impact of your storytelling against the specific goals you set for it. Chapter 7, Story and the CMO. As brand storytelling rewrites modern marketing, what role will the CMO play? In a recent interview, GE's CMO Linda Boff discussed the seismic shift happening in marketing. When we asked what future role the CMO will play when this transformation is complete, Boff replied, "You'll have to pardon me on this one, because I just watched Steve Jobs over the weekend with Michael Fassbender. And there's a line in there where Steve Wozniak says to Steve Jobs, 'You're not an engineer. You're not a product guy. You're not a programmer. What the hell do you do?' And Jobs says, 'I conduct the orchestra.' Well, I'm no Steve Jobs, but I also think the two essential roles of the marketer are conducting the corporate orchestra and setting the North Star vision. The primary focus of the lead marketer has been advertising campaign creation and optimization. CMOs polished the plans of their predecessors, made adjustments to include new outlets and technologies, and boosted performance over time. Today, the CMO occupies a new, critical, and far broader role in the company than ever before. Change agent. The CMO is change agent. Patterns of information and entertainment consumption have shifted so radically that every enterprise must adapt across every function. Companies that update their customer building techniques will achieve market leadership. Those that don't will fade away as their competitors, born to this new ecosystem and engineered for its success, replace them. Today's CMO must adapt her entire enterprise to a new reality. Your first task as change agent is to educate your executive team on the worldwide shift from ad-centric to story-centric marketing. No small task. Conventional C-suite wisdom holds that 6-year-olds crave stories, while hard-charging executives don't. But you know that if your company doesn't change its MO, it won't survive, so you must build a winning case to convince the C-suite. First, draw on the scientific research covered in Chapter 3 and demonstrate how story fits the mind. Explain how this fit provides an unparalleled opportunity to connect the minds in your company with the thoughts and feelings of your customers. Next, to win your case, master the techniques found in Chapter 13 and then prove how the positive impact of storytelling can be measured and geared to success. Once your executives are on board with the concept, teach the 8 stages of story creation to sales, marketing, product development, communications, investor relations, and leadership at all corporate levels. Finally, to put storytelling into practice, coach your team to change their thinking habits in 6 decisive ways. 1. Change your team's analytical method from deductive logic to causal logic. With unparalleled access to big data, executives often assume that given a sufficiently broad set of consistent observations, they can infer a general truth about the world. But business leaders who use induction as their sole basis for understanding the world often miss the causal links necessary for insightful decision-making. Suppose, for example, a diaper company were to commission a big data study that showed only a minuscule percentage of people born in 2010 use diapers, while virtually 100% of those born in 2017 wear them. If the marketing team were to stop thinking beyond those numbers, in other words, if they were to ignore the toilet training that causes them, they might happily forecast skyrocketing diaper use among the young and ramp up production. As absurd as this hypothetical may seem, the pattern is, in fact, commonplace. For decades now, number-based inductive logic has blinded many executives to causes and effects. Results can be ruinous. Coach your team to search below the surface of the data for the hows and whys hidden in those depths. 2. Change the team's sales practices from additive to progressive. Your education trained you to tell the world the good and only the good about your company. Facing a willing listener, you list as many positive attributes as possible. My company does this and this and this and this and this and this and this until you've exhausted the poor guy. In truth, You lost him with your first brag, because a sophisticated client knows there's good and bad in everything. If you present nothing but the good, he knows you're hiding the bad. He considers that lying and decides you cannot be trusted. In a storied approach, you progress by dramatizing an initial value change to begin the telling, then build to a greater value change, and climax on the greatest value change, revealing both the successes and obstacles along the way. Your story's progressive complications hold the attention of your audience while sharing a more complete, trustworthy, and convincing version of what you do. 3. Change the team's worldview from narrow and shallow to wide and deep. How does a story create meaningful value change? Through conflict. As outlined earlier, life contains four levels of conflict. Physical, battling a hurricane, a disease, the ticking clock of time. Social, struggles against institutions, perhaps discrimination, red tape, or power plays. Personal, antagonisms inside intimate relationships. And inner, wars within the mind over conflicting desires. Dove's Real Beauty stories drive their campaign by foregrounding the inner conflict of self-criticism versus self-appreciation. Apple's 2013 iPhone Christmas commercial pivoted around a misunderstanding within a family. Always is hashtag like a girl stories draw on the social antagonisms that cause systemic low self-esteem among women. In the last chapter, we discussed how the Michelin Baby in a Tire ad used life-threatening conflict on a highway to tell that company's story. Train your teams to work through all levels of antagonism so they can craft stories that resonate with the consumer. 4. Change your team's understanding of values. Convincing storytelling depends on an authenticity of values. Therefore, a transformational CMO ensures that the company has a strong core value that resonates with the entire team, that drives decision-making inside the organization, and ultimately, that inspires brand storytelling. Your stories should be entertaining, but they cannot be mere entertainment. They serve a greater purpose. By representing the core values of your business in the stories you tell, you have the opportunity to influence how people feel about your brand and increase their likelihood of purchase. We'll explore how to accomplish these goals in chapters 8, 9, and 10. 5. Change your team's marketing theory to embrace emotional intelligence. Marketers often begin their work by asking, "What facts do my customers need to know about my company's products and services?" They then design their campaigns to convey those particulars. But the trouble with the fact-driven technique is this. The key to decision-making is emotion, and emotion is not information. The emotionally targeted question you should ask is, "How do I want my customers to feel?" Your team members must frame their stories to create a feeling of fusion between protagonist and audience. When empathy seals the deal, use progressive conflict and value charge changes to hook and hold your audience. And finally, reward it with a story climax that reinforces brand or product values. 6. Change the team's mental model from static description to dynamic storytelling. Take away PowerPoint platforms and teach team members how to convert data to drama. The CMO is showrunner. I want to be a showrunner. Linda Boff, CMO of GE. We do not suggest that the CMO create her brand's stories personally. Rather, we would cast the CMO as a showrunner. Showrunner is the showbiz title for the master creator-producer behind today's brilliant long-form television series. This is the keeper of the vision, she who projects the story's arcs, season after season, and at the same time ensures that every detail in every scene not only harmonizes with the whole, but also sets up future payoffs. As corporate showrunner, the modern CMO educates her team in storycraft, produces a storytelling strategy for the brand, and operationalizes its storytelling processes. She recruits the right creatives, guides moment-by-moment storytelling to ensure brand voice alignment, and exercises good taste to guarantee a quality experience for the brand's prospective customers. It's a big job. Chapter 8. Storified Branding. Every CMO starts his day staring at this hard truth. Nobody wants to hear about your company or your product. For more than two centuries, marketers weathered this resistance by interrupting the ongoing pleasures of captive audiences with advertising. Some fortunate brands today triumph over advertising by reaching the saturation point of public awareness. When Apple or Samsung brings out a new gizmo, news media make it front-page stuff and diehard fans line up without seeing an ad. Those rarities aside, people do not spend their day waiting to hear about a new style of jeans or hip flavor of yogurt. Typically, consumers only debate brands in the mental minute before they make a purchase. That precious minute makes storified branding an imperative for modern marketing. The chapters ahead reveal how the purpose-told story incites a call to customer action. But this chapter first examines how branding stories lay the foundations for that action by cementing the brand in the consumer's mind and surrounding that image with positive associations. Brands that seal this emotional bond, GE, IBM, Always, succeed. Those that don't, struggle. Let's begin with a look at what brand means in the 21st century. Defining brand. Patrick Davis, CEO of Davis Brand Capital, DBC, developed a method for analyzing markets and developing differentiated brands. Marketing leaders such as Anheuser-Busch, InBev, Auto Trader, Chipotle, Progressive, Target, and Verizon attest to the excellence of Davis's system. All rely on DBC to help fathom, design, and develop corporate and product service brands. In a recent interview, Davis laid out his vision of the modern brand. Brand is a single organizing idea, a higher order construct that everything else comes from and aligns with. Sometimes I liken it to the fresh water that makes everything else possible, whether that is growing your crops or cleaning your clothes or making soup. It's that ingredient that goes across everything else. Finding a fresh source of water that won't be depleted and can be used in hundreds and hundreds of ways is a challenge. Which is to say, brand is intangible, it is abstract, and it is true. It has to be all of those things at once. The job of the marketer is to make it tangible and real, and to work with its truth to tell a story that is compelling, whether it happens in one image, or three lines, or a long-form piece. All of that is in service of saying we want brands to be a link between a number of positive associations for the consumer, and increasingly for communities and constituencies beyond the consumer, to say that we can all come together around this one big, higher-order idea. It is a belief system, and like any belief system, it has its language, it has symbols, it has rituals and behaviors to go with them. One clear example of brand rituals weaving through our culture is the phenomenon of badging. Davis explained, "What it means to hold a Bud Light is very different from what it means to hold a Budweiser, which is very different from what it means to hold a Stella Artois. Those brands are all owned by the same company, and in fact, consumers may choose those brands at different points in their weekend, because they are conveying different aspects of their personality with that badge, with a beer bottle they are holding. The brands we choose reflect how we see ourselves, or perhaps how we want the world to see us." Originally, Davis pointed out, brands were simply a means of identifying the producer. The purpose of the brand was to show that a certain person had made that specific piece. Whether silver goods, or porcelain, or leather goods, wares were hallmarked by their maker. In effect, they were branded like cattle. Through that brand, the maker was taking responsibility for the quality of the goods. If the buyer had a problem, she could return to the maker for satisfaction. Today, however, Davis notes, the mark is just a shortcut, a signal for the brand. The brand still exists beyond the product and beyond the mark. And that's when you get into some very interesting work. How can you create a brand that matters so much to people that they make it a part of their self-expression? For generations, television advertising did the trick. Not anymore. To connect with audiences today, we need a different approach. And it had better be good, because we've got a steep hill to climb. The modern antipathy to corporations. On September 18th, 2015, the United States Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, accused Volkswagen of knowingly and willfully violating federal law by selling 428,000 diesel cars equipped with defeat devices. Volkswagen programmed these cars with special software designed to evade environmental tests. When tested in a lab, their diesel engines operated more efficiently, but far less powerfully, meeting required environmental standards. When later operating on the road, they operated differently, emitting nitrous oxide at 40